I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us again this Friday. In the next hour, we'll learn more about a recently elected leader for one northern Wisconsin tribe. Plus, we'll hear about efforts to reform a program that aids flood victims in the wake of Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. But up first, we speak with Red Cliff Tribal Chairman Rick Peterson. He was elected as the tribe's new leader this past July. He sat down with me last week at Red Cliff's Tribal Administration Office to talk about why he ran, his vision for the Red Cliff Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and his experience prior to becoming tribal chairman.
I was born and raised here. Never really left the reservation outside of Duluth until I was probably 18 when I joined the military. I was gone for 4 years at that time, and after that, to make a long story short, I ended up in California and in the Los Angeles area, accepted a couple of jobs that I absolutely hated. One of them was roofing, and it was at that point, and nothing against roofers, you know, it was hot and it was a nasty job. They used that hot tar, and it was at that point I decided, I was probably 23, 24 years old, I decided that this is my life from here on out unless I do something to change it. So I started taking college courses at night, and over the course of the next 7 years, I was able to obtain my business degree and a minor in marketing. And then I went to work for, actually it was probably about 5 years into college, I went to work for GE Aircraft Engines, Garrett Aviation at LAX, and I ended up staying there 20 years. Yeah, I worked in various capacities there and purchasing, worked maintenance out in the hangar and several other things, and I always left my resume on Monster, just for no particular reason, just always left it out there. And I had no desire to leave General Electric. GE is a good job. I'd been there forever. And one day I got an email from a company called SpaceX, Space Exploration Technologies. They were operating over in the next town over in El Segundo. And I called them up and spoke to them, and they said, oh, yeah, we're building rockets.
Are you talking about the company that's owned by Elon Musk?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The company was pretty much in its infancy at that point, and I agreed to go over and talk to them and walked in the door, and they were building rockets, like real rockets. At the point where I walked in, they had fired off two rockets already, which crashed, to make it bluntly. And I came in at the beginning of flight three. I actually had to interview with Elon, and one of the things I'll always remember about the interview was I was telling him, I said, I got it made over at GE. I said, I've been there forever. I got a ton of, vacation time and this and that. And he smiled and he said, we got free lunches. And which they did, it was funny. We both laughed, and I ended up taking the job. And flight three, they launched them out of Kwajalein down on the equator. It's an atoll down there, and that flight made it almost into orbit, and at the last second didn't make it. It exploded. And then after that, Elon came out and he said, we're going to do one more. And we built a fourth rocket, and that one made it into orbit. And the rest is, like you said, history. That, we started out of four warehouses, and now they're getting ready next year to send astronauts up to the space station. So, but in telling that story, I tell it for a reason. I have a 10-year-old daughter who at the time was only three, and I decided at that point I would rather have her come go to school at a smaller school as opposed to in Los Angeles. And that dictated our move back here. We came back in 2011. And when I came back in 2011, I worked in a couple of different capacities. I was a marketing director of the casino for a little while, but then I worked in tribal administration for about 3 years. Then I accepted a job up at the clinic working in grants management, and that's where I stayed until the election this year. And what I thought I could bring in saying that, you know, telling that, I felt that I had something to offer. In the 30 years I was away, not only the education, but the experience that I had in working with two of the most successful companies, I felt that I had something more to offer. And, you know, I wanted to utilize that experience, that education, to help, you know, benefit our community.
What's your vision then for Red Cliff? What would you like to see happen for the tribe in the coming years?
I think one of the problems with not only with Red Cliff but with many tribes is many, especially rural tribes that are out in the middle of nowhere and things like that, where things like gaming really don't gain the traction that they do in casinos that are in the city and stuff like that. I think on the economic development side, I think we have a lot to offer here, and in terms of business, but one of the problems that tribes have is that they become dependent on grants. 110%, they're dependent on grants, and that is what they know. That is what they depend on, and it's my goal to break that cycle. We live in a beautiful area here in the middle of the Apostle Islands. You look at other towns nearby here, such as Bayfield, where the population quadruples at a minimum in the summertime. And with my experience and my education, I believe that I can take, or at least begin to lead this tribe down the path to taking advantage and taking advantage of that natural business opportunity there.
What kind of businesses would you like to see then, or do you feel would fit the character of the tribe and the reservation?
Well, I think one of the, you know, I mean, tourism up in this area, as we know, like I said, you know, we're in the middle of the Apostle Islands, and tourism is a big thing. We have the casino, but it's my feeling that there's other aspects of that casino that could help benefit the tourism. We're working on right now, just since I came into office, we're focusing on with the casino manager and several other departments here in upgrading the marina, bringing that, you know, boating is a huge, huge industry up here, obviously, with the lake. Bringing it up to a standard where it can be the premier destination right in the whole area here, you know. And you know, and it's not just about building pretty docks. It's about having services that people take for granted now, and they want. You want Wi-Fi. You want cell phone service. You want all these different things that are. I mean, we don't give it a second thought during the day, but when you come up to a rural area like up here, and all of a sudden it's not there, that's where you kind of realize how dependent you are on it. And, you know, everyday life now is dependent on a lot of those services. And so we're focusing on the marina. The tribe recently purchased the Buffalo Bay gas station up here. So one of the things we'll probably be able to do and we're looking at is providing fueling services down there, which they, you know, in the marina, which they don't have now. And there, other things I'd like to do is I would like to begin more technology-based business, internet-based businesses. We have a lot of, within the tribal communities, within Indian communities, you have a lot of arts and crafts, and you have a lot of different things like that. And the way it's been in the past is, you know, those items have always been sold out of brick-and-mortar buildings, you know, just the four walls. And, you know, I mean, with the internet now, I mean, the world is realistically at your doorstep. You know, we just need to build upon that. And I went down to the school recently. I was asked to speak about my career during their career days. And one of the things that has always, you know, and I relay this to some of the teachers down there. So one of the problems Red Cliff has always had and other rural tribes is that, you know, we teach our kids to fly like eagles, but we don't give them anywhere to land once they do. You know, we need to create economic opportunities that are, you know, we have a full clinic up here, up the road. I mean, we have dental services, we have medical service, we have chiropractic, we have behavioral health, we have all this. And our young tribal members who go off to school, I want to give them somewhere to come back to if they want to.
So you mentioned the internet-based businesses. How are you working towards that then? Because I know it can be expensive for telecommunications companies to make that case to lay down the fiber. It can be like 30 to 40 grand a mile or something like that. Mm-hmm. So how is that working for you?
Well, the past administration, I've only been in office now a little over a month, but I believe that they were thinking along the same lines, and there, and over the past summer, the fiber optic lines are actually being laid as we speak. You'll see all around the reservation now where the fiber optics are. I mean, I don't know how long. I think the project is scheduled to be completed by the end of October. So, I mean, yeah, the foundation is being laid right now to expand upon. This was something that the past administration started working on, and our IT director here at the tribe has kind of been spearheading it along with them to ensure that the fiber optics are in all of the critical areas within the tribe, in the housing units, and run along the major thoroughfares in and out of here. We've just run it up to the gas station. And one of our tribal members, who was the former owner of the gas station, has started a business right across the street, and he has expressed interest in tapping into that line already. He's building a distillery right across the street, and he's expressed interest in it. And you know, I mean, the word is already out there that we're upgrading that whole system.
Are there other parts of economic development that you want to see for the tribe? Or is that pretty much your concept, is to bring in home-based businesses and see that grow?
Not only home-based businesses. I mean, the tribe in and of itself can begin. I mean, there's countless businesses now that the tribe can become involved with that are technology-based. We have a lot of creative tribal members, a lot of artists and a lot of different things like that. And one of the programs that the school does down there now, the Bayfield School, is they have like film classes, and they have different things like that. And, you know, I mean, this is something that I definitely think is an opportunity also.
What about housing and healthcare? Because I know that's been an issue too in rural areas for tribes. Are there things that you're working on related to that, or how do you feel with housing and healthcare right now?
Well, here in Red Cliff, we do have a severe housing shortage, as many tribes do, and it's multifaceted. We don't have a lot of land base. You know, it's a relatively small reservation compared to like the Navajo and so on and so forth, where they have, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of acres. When the reservation was first founded, ratified, I believe we had 14,000 acres is what the original boundaries were. Now they're down to 8 or 8,500. And so, I mean, the housing shortage, I mean, that's only part of it. And the other part is funding. You know, you got to put, again, our tribe is like no different than any other ones in an economic capacity. I mean, we don't have endless dollars to go out and start building, you know, housing units. So, I mean, again, we rely on help from the federal government and other federal sources to make this happen. And, you know, it's a process that unfortunately leaves tribal members that would like to live out here, you know, they have to look at other options. In regard to the health care, I touched on that a little bit earlier. When I was growing up here, any little ache or pain or dental, you had to go to Ashland. That's the way it was. If you had anything more severe, it was Duluth or Marshfield or wherever. Over the Redcliffe, it started probably about 20 years ago. Redcliffe started just a small little community health center that, ironically, is out of this administration building now. Is where, well, it started across the street. Then it was moved into this building. This building was built, and over time it grew and it grew and it grew, and they actually outgrew this building. And through the help of the Shakopee tribe, we were able to build our new community health center up the road here about 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And the services up there are tremendous. I mean, you know, for a rural area like this, you know, the services that are available are second to none, really, out in this area. Like I said, we have medical doctors, we have dentists, we have a full dental facility, we have a pediatrician, we have a pediatric dentist, we have chiropractor, we have behavioral health. You know, it's just amazing. We have a full pharmacy and x-ray. So in regard to the health, you know, obviously you want the best, but we're doing pretty good in regard to healthcare around here, from the services that we are able to offer. And it's not only benefiting tribal members. I mean, individuals from Bayfield that are, you know, the town 3 miles away, they're able to utilize it. From, you know, all the other small little communities, they're able to utilize it as well.
In addition to housing and healthcare, then I wanted to ask you about state or federal tribal relations and how that's going between Redcliffe and, say, the state of Wisconsin or the federal government. Do you feel like you have good relationship when you're working through issues like the Lake Superior Fishing Agreement or other issues involving ceded territory?
Yeah. I mean, when you're working with both the federal and the state governments, I mean, you have so many different divisions and, you know, departments and whatnot. You're going to have good relationships and you're going to have bad relationships. And I like to think that since I've been in this office, I've had a pretty good rapport, I'll put it, with the DNR on moving forward with the, you know, on negotiating the fishing agreement. The state, I just got back from a meeting in Milwaukee where there was some State Department officials that were there, and they were very receptive to the concerns and issues that we are facing, especially here in like I said, rural northern Wisconsin. We don't have a lot of the resources that they would have around the bigger cities of Madison and Milwaukee and so on and so forth. And they were very receptive in trying to, in committing to helping us address those. And but in regard to the federal government, it's going to be interesting because there's, you know, I mean, a budget has not been finalized yet. We've looked at the proposed budgets and it doesn't look good for Native Americans. It really doesn't. I mean, there's some drastic cuts that are coming to the Department of Interior and the BIA, which is going to trickle down to us. And so, I mean, once a budget is finalized, you know, I mean, that's going to help determine, you know, the relationship we have with them, for, you know, moving forward. You know, right now, there's a lot of tribes out in Washington, D.C., you know, voicing their opinions and trying to get them to change some of the proposals that are in there. That, you know, some of them are going to devastate some tribes throughout the country.
What are some of the proposals under the federal budget that would impact the Red Cliff tribe?
You know, one of the huge ones is the proposed cuts to the Department of Interior, which the BIA is a part of, and that's going to have a direct impact on Red Cliff. Tribes depend upon the BIA for many services, and they're also talking about cutting, health services, IHS funding. All of that is in the pipeline right now, and we're crossing our fingers and doing everything we can. I spoke a little bit ago about our clinic. Our clinic has, a huge part of the success of that clinic has been IHS,
Indian Health Service.
And, there's proposed cuts to that also. It's disturbing and concerning and frustrating and, watching what's happening. And then you walk out your door and you see where these cuts are going to hit. They're not going to hit Washington, D.C. They're going to hit Red Cliff. They're going to hit Bad River. They're going to hit, other small reservations throughout the country.
So do you think that there's an awareness of the needs in Indian country or respect for the culture that exists there from the state and federal governments, or local for that matter? I mean, you have a lot of relationships with surrounding cities and counties, so.
I believe there is, especially on the local level. You do. I mean, I just attended a fishing symposium yesterday down in Bayfield where one of our tribal cultural leaders kind of led the opening ceremony, and we were invited to that. And in regard to the state also, I think the state works more closely with the tribes than I believe the federal government does. Like I said, there's just that, we are neighbors with the state, whereas the federal government, I mean, they're out halfway across the United States from us. And for me personally, we have our local representatives, and congressmen and stuff like that, but it's still, I feel a disconnect there, in regard to, especially with cultural.
What do you wish that not just governments, but people in general understood about Indian country, about the Red Cliff tribe here in northern Wisconsin? I mean, as far as like you spoke to culture, mm-hmm. and awareness of that. So what do you wish people would understand about Red Cliff tribal members, about your history, about your culture?
Well, I guess the thing I would like them to understand is that what happened hundreds of years ago when our land was taken from us. I mean, realistically, that's what happened. And we were here first. And you fast forward to modern day, and what I think is lost there is that respect in many cases. What I guess I ask is just respect our culture, respect who we are as a people. We are a sovereign nation, and I ask, I just ask that respect.
I guess kind of on that note of respect, there's been a lot of proposals lately, it seems like, with extractive industry, whether it's mining projects or oil pipeline projects. And a lot of that either runs through ceded territory or through reservations themselves. So what is the tribe's feeling, or your feelings for that matter, about these types of projects and the future of them?
Well, again, it goes back to respecting our sovereignty. Unfortunately, what just happened out in Standing Rock, I was proud of the stand that was taken, of the determination of the protesters. But at the end of the day, it was the federal courts that came in and, they dictated that the pipeline could go on. And, it's frustrating. The future of that, the tribes should have a say at the table. They should have a seat at the table. When these projects are proposed, a lot of times they're not. You look at Standing Rock, okay? The reason that the route was taken, the route that was approved for the line. The reason it was there was because it was actually proposed earlier up in a more densely populated area. I believe it was Fargo, and they didn't want it. So what did they do? They pushed it off on Indian land. You know, so I mean, where's the equality in that? They didn't want it for whatever reason, and now so they push it off on Indian land. You know, it was kind of like when I lived in California, I remember one of the hot topics out there was nuclear waste from nuclear reactors, and one of the places they ended up putting it was on the Navajo reservation because nobody else wanted it. You just kind of feel like there's no respect in there, you know. The sovereignty of our countries are just not taken into consideration.
So as far as these projects that are being considered, do you have a stance on them?
Yeah. We formally opposed those that Enbridge. We formally opposed them. We have voiced our concern during the discussion periods, and we stand by our fellow tribes that are at the forefront of it.
When you say we're opposed to them, do you mean like all their pipeline projects or just the ones that would specifically run through ceded territory? Or
well, it would be the ones that run you know through the reservation lands, and you know, and also even within the ceded territory, any pipeline that's going to pose a risk to the environment, the water. I mean, this lake, I grew up on this lake, and one of the things about this lake that is different from an oil spill in the ocean is that there's nowhere for that oil to go. When I got out of the military, I went to Alaska and I fished out of Kodiak Island, and I was actually up there in 1989 during the Exxon Valdez spill. And words alone cannot describe the devastation, the smell, the sludge. The animals were just, you know, they were stuck in it. They were dying, you know. It was on the rocks. It was up in there, but it was horrific. And if something like that ever happened on this lake or any lake, inland lake, I mean, that would be the end of it. I still speak to some friends of mine up there, and, you know, they talk about the oil spill, and they said there's areas out there in, you know, these real outlying areas where you can dig down in the sand on the beaches 2-3 feet, and you can still find oil there. It doesn't go away, you know, but the majority of it, you know, the ocean currents have taken a lot of it away. We don't have that option here. You get an oil spill of that magnitude on this lake, this lake is done. All the fisheries, all the, you know, the boating, the recreational, you know, kiss it goodbye. It's gone.
Well, I guess aside from extractive industries, is there anything else that I'm missing that you want to add or that you want people to know about your plans?
You know, the main thing is, you know, we welcome you. You know, we consider, we're a peaceful people. We don't like conflict. As far as Red Cliff goes, come here and visit us. We're your friends. I hope someday that when you do come up here and you do come and visit, you leave with a good feeling.
Again, that was Red Cliff Tribal Chairman Rick Peterson talking about his vision for the tribe during his next 2-year term and the issues affecting their members. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll hear from Northern Wisconsin Congressman Sean Duffy about efforts to reform a national program that aids flood victims in the wake of Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us again this Friday. Flooding has claimed lives and caused millions of dollars in damage for northern and southern Wisconsin in the past year. And with recent floods from Hurricanes Harvey and Irma in Texas and Florida, thousands are seeking help to rebuild from the National Flood Insurance Program. The program was created in 1968 after private insurers realized it was too costly to cover people living in areas at risk of flooding. And a report out this month from the Congressional Budget Office says that program is deeply in debt. Republican Wisconsin Congressman Sean Duffy and a Democratic colleague are pushing to make changes to the program. Duffy joined me by phone yesterday to talk about reforms they'd like to see and the status of the program.
Well, so first off, we have to recognize that the flood insurance program does a couple of things. One, it encourages people to live in dangerous areas, to live in a floodplain. And frankly, it subsidizes them to do that. And when disasters hit, not only are their lives put in peril, but then we also have first responders who risk their own lives to save people who the government has subsidized to live in these dangerous places. On top of that, it's a program that's $25 billion in debt before Harvey and Irma hit, and that potentially could actually double. And so I think what it's important to do is recognize that with this program, we need to look at how do we look at areas of the country that continually flood and homes that have repeat claims, their policies. And if we can incentivize them to move out of those dangerous areas into safer places, one, they live in a safer home, but two, there's less risk to the federal government. So I think that's important, number one. Number two, this space is exclusively run by the federal government. There's a lot of private insurance companies that would like to offer policies to homeowners that, because of the way the rules are structured right now, it's really challenging for the private market to come in. And so with some slight tweaks, we can make reforms that allow the private sector to offer people policies in conjunction with the National Flood Insurance Program. And so you have people competing for your business as a homeowner. And, you know, we have if my daughter just got a license. When she crashes the car, my auto insurance rate. But in the National Flood Insurance Program, if you get flooded not just one time, but six times or eight times or 12 times, your rates never go up. You're grandfathered into the first rate that you ever received. And so I think we have to look at how do we get people on a slight escalator to pay close to a more actuarially sound rate on their properties for the risk that they pose. And I know that's challenging for people in, you know, poorer areas. I mean, because the cheapest land that was available usually in a community was floodplain land. And so a lot of poor people built there. And so we have to be cognizant of how we help poor people. But we also have, whether you want to look at the Hamptons in New York or coastal property in Florida, a lot of wealthy people buy that property and build really nice homes, and they get into the National Flood Insurance Program. How do we take a look at the rates that they pay? And do those people really need to be subsidized by the federal government? So we got to look at, again, the cost of the program, the premiums that people pay. We have to look at the incentives that we put in place that allow people to build in really dangerous areas. And we have to look at basically the fundamentals of the program and try to bring in a little more revenue to meet the costs of the National Flood Insurance Program. And I would just note that, you know, there's about 5% of the American public that gets subsidized by the other 95% of America in regard to flood insurance.
So what are some of the key changes then that you're seeking under this? And if you could talk to some of the incentives for people to move out of floodplains.
So, yeah, so number one, there's a bill called Ross-Castor that will allow banks who are required to have people buy flood insurance, allow a tweak to the law that will allow them to accept a policy other than the National Flood Insurance Policy. That's a key reform. We are going to put a surcharge on policies so more money will go into the National Flood Insurance Reserve fund. So when disasters like this happen, there's more money in the reserve to actually pay for them. But we also look at the properties that repetitively flood. And when it's in the benefit of the program, the flood insurance program, we want to come in and make an offer to buy their house. Now, if they don't want to sell their house, they don't have to. We're not in the business of forcing people to sell. But if we get to paying for your house twice, the value of your home twice, so 200%, we would tell folks, listen, if you don't want to sell, you don't have to, but you're going to have to get a policy in the private market. Those are just some of the common sense reforms that we have, in addition to just structural issues like trying to modernize the mapping of these flood areas to really get a grasp on the risk that they pose. Oftentimes we use old technology, but there's a lot of new technology that has come online that allows us to get better elevations, better see how our topography will flood when a big rains or storm surges come in. So we want to incentivize the National Flood Insurance Program to actually get about doing more and better mapping.
I just wanted to go back what you said about the homes. This reform or the legislation would actually offer to buy people out of their homes so that they could move elsewhere?
Yes. So it has to be in the benefit of the program. But I was just down in Houston, and, you know, we went and looked at a neighborhood, or what used to be a neighborhood, where two rivers converged into one. And between those two rivers, before they met, it was a development. And Houston, in conjunction with the state and the National Flood Insurance Program, they actually came in and bought up a lot of the homes in there because they continually flood. Now, there's a few homes that are left that we can't force them to sell, and they're still in the National Flood Insurance Program, and they flood every year to every other year. If we were able to get them to move because they can get to a better place, they would actually be able to dig out, almost create a bathtub in that area where when heavy rains come, that bathtub fills up of water and doesn't flood homes downstream. But when it's not flooding, you have green space with soccer fields and hiking trails and biking trails. So you have great community use in non-dangerous times. But when significant flooding happens, it offers a great reservoir to hold a rain runoff. So to get to your point, when it's in the benefit of the program, yes, we have a proposal that will incentivize people to sell their homes. We can turn it back to green space and they can move somewhere safer. We also put $1 billion over the 5-year reauthorization of this bill to help people mitigate their homes. This doesn't work for every property, but there's some properties where you can actually raise your home and put it above the traditional flood levels. And we have a program that will help people mitigate their homes. The government coming in and helping folks make sure that when floods do come, their homes aren't damaged.
And is this the same bill that you introduced earlier this year then?
So I organized 3 packages of bills that were introduced. We passed them through the committees. But, you know, there's some people who have had some concerns with some of the language in the bills. One was, and I took this out, but I thought, if you have $1 million structure, now not your land, you don't have a great piece of land on Lake Superior. This is just the structure on your land. If the structure is worth $1 million and private flood insurance is available in your state, I thought that those people should go into the private market as opposed to going into a subsidized federal flood insurance program. They're wealthy. Well, I got a lot of pushback on that, and so I had to take it out. I thought that newer construction and expensive construction, we should try to push that into the private market. I lost on that as well. So I made modifications since the first bill that I introduced because I couldn't get the votes to pass it. So I've worked with Democrats and Republicans to tweak and massage my bill in a way that will still give us good reform, but also be able to pass across the House floor.
So has it been taken up then yet, or do you think it will be taken up soon?
So the program was going to expire at the end of September, but with the debt limit and the funding of the government, there was a 3-month extension, and flood was included in that. So the flood insurance program is authorized until the early part of December. My bill will come to the floor sometime before then. Now, the National Flood Insurance Program, the NFIP, is going to have to come to Congress and get more borrowing authority. They have no money left. So we might ask for, in exchange for more money, a few of the tweaks that are more agreeable in my bill to have those included on the extra money that goes to the NFIP.
And did I see that that program is in debt at $24 billion?
So right now the debt is like $24.5 billion. That very well may double. Now, in an average year outside of a year like we've had this year or Katrina or Sandy, Superstorm Sandy, the program on average runs a $1.5 billion deficit a year. So it brings in about $3.5 billion in revenue and puts out about $5 billion in their expenses. So the program is a major subsidy. And again, it's about thinking not back in the past, but thinking to the future of what do we want these programs to look like? How do you make them sustainable? Earl Blumenauer, who is one of the lead environmental congressmen in the House, has partnered with me in this process because, you know, he has a belief these shorelines should be left as green space. Why are we building in these areas and putting people at risk, you know, costing the federal government more money when they should be left in their natural state? They're not made to have homes and structures put on them. So the two of us have partnered up. We're kind of two unlikely allies, but we're friends, and we've worked together to try to come together and bring a unique mindset of members of Congress to come up with and vote for solutions that'll fix the program, or not fix it, but, you know, put it on a trajectory that's more sustainable and smarter.
So are you hopeful then that it'll be addressed in December once the authorization needs to be addressed?
So, yep. So I think this our bill, I have been told, will come up for a vote. And this is not all the reform that I would like, but I'm getting a lot of the reform that I've asked for. And I think we're moving the program in the right direction, which is key. And it's a really unique program, too, in that you have not party divides necessarily. They don't divide up by, you know, liberal and conservative and Republican and Democrat. You oftentimes see coastal members of Congress, Democrats and Republicans, pushing back, wanting more subsidies, wanting more construction in these dangerous areas that they represent. And then you have, you know, other groups that go, well, there should be a more thoughtful process on how we do that. And is this the smartest land use policy coming from the federal government? And again, if you've ever been in a flooded home and smelled and seen the devastation, that people would actually live in that kind of environment, it's frankly tragic. And then when you see, again, first responders paddling in on boats trying to save people's lives, and in the process they lose their own life, the moral hazard of what we do is an important component of analyzing a program and making sure we're learning lessons. And again, trying to take care of people, not putting, you know, people and homeowners in a bind, but slowly changing and shifting our thought process on what we do on federal flood insurance and what we do for land use on where we build in America.
Well, I really appreciate you talking about this. And just kind of on a sort of related note, since you brought up the authorization of, we've been kind of seeing this in the recent years where there's talk of a government shutdown and look to continuing resolutions to keep the government operating. Do you feel like we're going to be able to come to some sort of compromise, or that this is just kind of the new norm?
Well, I don't think continuing resolutions are the way to govern. And I think we want to pass budgets and we want to appropriate money through the appropriations process. I would tell you that the way the system is now set up, it's incredibly challenging to actually pass a budget and go through the appropriations process in, you know, the 5-month period in which the calendar year is set up to do that. And so I do think it's important to look at how do we reform the rules of budgeting and appropriating to make the process work a lot better. But I thought it was pretty unique that unlikely allies in Donald Trump and Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, you know, they came together and cut this deal And so, you know, that's a sign of some bipartisanship. You know, I look at, you know, healthcare reform. I don't know that you're going to see a lot of bipartisanship on that. I think the divide is based on politics and parties and views of the world. But I do think there's a real opportunity on tax reform to get Democrats and Republicans to come to some form of an agreement. Maybe my eternal glass is always half full. But I think when you do big things that have a huge impact on the American people, if you can do things in a bipartisan way, you get a far better product, you get better American buy-in, and you get better legislation. So I'm hopeful that we'll see people wanting to cooperate and work together.
Well, I know on tax reform that Paul Ryan had said earlier this year that he'd hope to have something passed by Thanksgiving. Do you think that's a realistic timeline?
You know, Paul did indicate he would like something by Thanksgiving, or I think he said by deer hunting was his reference. And you were hearing rumors that we'll see some of these plans coming out next week. And if that's the case, we should be in a good place to actually debate it, tweak it, vote on it, and hopefully have it done, yes, by mid-November to early December.
And how far off do you think is a resolution on health care?
Well, I have stopped trying to predict what the Senate is going to do. I don't know how they're going to perform, how people are going to vote, how this bill is going to be tweaked. So I'll sit and watch and see what they do. And if they pass something, we'll deal with it then. But right now, I have no prediction as to what they will get done or what they won't get done.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me again today. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Danielle.
Again, you were just listening to Northern Wisconsin Congressman Sean Duffy. We're going to take a short break for these announcements. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this Friday. We just wanted to leave you in this hour with a story about craft beer. More than 5,200 craft breweries are operating across the country, according to the Brewers Association. That's more than double the number that existed 5 years ago. Wisconsin's craft breweries grew around 40% during the same time span. Felicity Bosk takes us on a tour of brewers in northern Wisconsin to get their take on the growing cultural trend.
A train blares in the background as Tim Nelson gives me a tour of the production site for his new business, Earth Rider Brewery. The site is in the heart of Superior's industrial waterfront, with ships and trains coming and going from nearby slips. The brewery is still under construction, but Nelson says he's excited to be opening a brewery in Superior.
The craft beer industry has seen a big growth over the last 10 years. We're able now to fill in areas that haven't had breweries for a long time, such as Superior. We have over 5,000 in the country right now. In 2 years, we'll probably have over 8,000 breweries. So the trends are not slowing. People are still purchasing and loving to have local craft beer. So we're excited to be a part of that movement.
Nelson says they're building a 20-barrel system that can produce 40 kegs at a time. After the first few months, he says they'll begin packaging beer in cans. Nelson says it will be the first packaging brewery in Superior since 1967, and consumer demand is a driving force behind his plans.
I think there's a bigger vision by a lot of people to consume and support localized anything, whether it be food or beer or other products.
Thirsty Pagan in Superior has been brewing craft beer for customers to drink at its bar and restaurant since the 1990s. Owner Stephen Knaus believes part of the appeal of craft beer is where it's brewed.
Thirsty Pagan isn't offered anywhere else. I mean, we're not anywhere else. We're right here in Superior, Wisconsin, population 27,000. Are you kidding me? You know, and people come here from Madison, Chicago, Minneapolis, St. Paul, of course, you know, and we get people coming here from all over the world because we have beer and they're excited to drink it.
Jason Coles of Fargo is having lunch with his family at Thirsty Pagan and drinking a Derailed Ale, one of the Brewpub's craft beers. Cole says he stops in every time they're in Superior.
Here, I was here one time and they had a beer that they brewed with their own yeast that they had harvested. That was really cool, because then you can get truly local.
Craft brewers in northern Wisconsin believe another reason they're seeing demand for their beer is that it's brewed with Lake Superior water. Earthrider brewmaster Frank Kazuba says it's perfect for brewing.
Lake Superior's water is amazing, partially because it is very soft. That means it's lacking hardness, it's lacking a lot of magnesium and calcium. And that means you can brew pretty much any style of beer that you want to.
Wisconsin ranks 10th in the nation for producing just under 1 million barrels of craft beer each year. Republican lawmakers recently introduced a bill that would allow craft brewers to expand production. Brew pubs would be able to make twice as much beer each year. Representative Dale Quinga says the bill levels the playing field among all brewers.
Especially if Wisconsin becomes like the Napa Valley of beer, which we historically have, but we're losing momentum in that space, is I believe by supporting both our big breweries, small breweries, and everyone in between, is that Wisconsin could continue to be recognized as the brewery state.
Nelson says one of the reasons he chose to build his brewery in Superior is that Wisconsin is a beer-friendly state.
It's become really a top-of-mind thing for a lot of politicians and administrators around the country and locally, that this is something that's really good for the economy.
Nelson and other brewers are more than happy to raise a glass to those supporting their craft. Felicity Bosk, Wisconsin Public Radio.
That's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You can also check us out on our Facebook page at facebook.com/KUWSFM. And you can find us on iTunes under Hear Me Out. I'm Danielle Kading, and you've been listening to Hear Me Out here on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great weekend.